You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Ann Malik, chairman of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, and Dave Norris, mayor of the city of Charlottesville, spoke at the March 10, 2010 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following brief opening remarks by the panelists, questions were taken from the audience. Our podcast is entitled The State of the City and County. The program was moderated by SSV board member Jim Perkins.
I'd like to outline just the format because it's very brief today. We're going to have a forum which is presenting the state of the county and the state of the city. We've asked these people to come and join us. We'll start off with Ann Malik, who is the chair of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors, and she'll be followed by the state of the city by Mayor Dave Norris. And we ask that you hold your questions until after both Ann and Dave have made their presentations, and then we will be among you with the microphones, because this is podcast, and we want all your questions recorded, and the answers, of course, will be recorded too. So we'll be coming around with those microphones. Just raise your hand. We are very privileged to have Ann Malik and Dave Norris here with us. You know a lot about their backgrounds. You know how much they have given to both the county and the city. And I'm not going to go into their bios because we have those in our newsletters, and those copies are back there. But I would like to acknowledge their service to both the county and the city as volunteers and as members of an organization of organizations that catch a lot of controversy and deal with all these issues to make decisions for us all. So please give them a round of applause for their volunteer service. Thank you. So with that, I'd like to start with Ann Malik, who is the chair of the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors. Ann?
And please speak up if I don't speak loudly enough into the microphone. Thank you so much for the invitation and for the ability to be here to discuss things with you and to hear your questions. I'm a person who likes to learn from every avenue I can. I'm descended from a 13th century Irish lady pirate, which some people say gives them some understanding about my personality. The granddaughter of Rachel Carson, environmentalist, and the daughter of two veterinarians, I wear many hats which use different skills and different interests. I'm a farmer, a biologist, a school teacher, and all these experiences provide me with ways to support my major goals as a supervisor for Albemarle County: representation of the citizens in the Whitehall District and collaboration, which means we need to work together to accomplish anything. The roundtable aspects of elementary classroom education apply directly to getting voters of very different points of view to understand each other and to work together. I meet spring and fall with the voters in my district to share their concerns and get their ideas on solutions we can use. As elected officials from the city and the county, Dave and I and the city councilors and supervisors need to focus on these collaborative skills more and more to work together better. Being chair this year is an extension of the same goal, making sure that all points of view can be expressed in a safe zone for discussion, that people stay at the negotiating table until they can find a solution. With most of our local issues, the option to fail is not acceptable. Or as long as a research professor of mine years ago said, persistence is an important skill because the impossible takes a little longer. The character of the rural area that I represent is a living, breathing life form, not a museum. It has an ecosystem benefit like watershed protection, provides land for growing food, provides living spaces for about half of the residents of the county. Scenic value provides the daily quality of life and attracts those wonderful tourist dollars. As appealing as our new growth area Crozet neighborhoods are, some folks just want to live out in the country where it's dark and there aren't any services. What are some issues where we have succeeded in the last couple of years? Highlight of mine would be the 100-foot stream buffers that have been applied to the entire county rather than just the western half. That provides no construction in the floodplains around our streams. And with the January 25th rain event in our minds, we know the kind of damage that water can provide and how if buildings or lawn chairs or grills had been down in those water areas, they would have been at the neighbor's front door. The adoption of consistent driveway standards in the zoning and subdivision ordinances, steep slope limits for driveway construction, and most importantly to me, improvements to the erosion and sediment regulations that will protect our rural areas. For large projects in the growth area, time limits now exist in which permanent cover must be reestablished on areas where soil is disturbed. No longer will large acreages be left red and barren for years, losing soil downstream to their neighbors. To me, the result will always be better if public participation occurs in a really active way, and your being here today is a great example of the way you participate. Master plans and their careful revision every 5 years and implementation all along are essential to achieve community desires. Over 700 surveys were returned by Crozet residents during this past summer as the lead up to their master plan revision. Their first master plan was adopted in 2004. The public discussion part of the master plan revision is just about complete. There were 5 monthly meetings. Over 100 people came to each one. They came to discuss particular ideas of ways to change and improve the implementation of the master plan, and also to work with staff who had recommendations about ways to make it all better and to achieve better outcomes for the population densities over 20 years. This has been a really unifying example for a community that just 5 years ago was pretty well torn apart by the whole population issue. Our county budget process is another example of how meeting with residents helps supervisors understand the will of the people. Each member has a slightly different perspective on government services. While I'm sure we all truly want the same thing, a vibrant community with clean air and water and good jobs for people, how we get there is sometimes where we differ. Staff has made great strides to implement the direction of the new majority on the board, passed on January 6th. To involve more active assistance from our business communities to help economic development activities come to the front. The debate continues on what is a core service. How the county should tax itself to provide services. Should the county step in to supplement accounts that have been gutted by state cuts? We continue to learn details on the state budget every day. One thing we know is that the state Senate budget is much kinder to Albemarle and to Charlottesville than the House of Delegates budget. These two have to be reconciled in conference, and how it comes out will make a big difference to our future here. The Senate cuts Albemarle County 8%, and the House cuts it 15%. Cuts are even worse for the city, with cuts up to 30% over 2 years from the dreaded House budget. I have no information about the success or failure of the school board's attempt to the amendment to the budget and in some ways to claim some funds currently sent to the city. As the record shows, I was not in favor of that amendment. I think that we achieve much better goals in the short term and the long run by building cooperative bridges and working jointly to reduce costs. And I've been involved in many community activities, such as CHART, where we have regional planning that's been very successful. In addition to the funding issues, there are challenges ahead from outside forces. Energy efficiency and stormwater controls to repair our streams and rivers and thus benefit the Chesapeake Bay. On energy efficiency, another great example of city-county cooperation. Last year, the two jurisdictions applied for and won a $500,000 grant to facilitate widespread weatherization improvements in residential properties in our two jurisdictions. The LEAP, or Local Energy Alliance Program, brings together electric utilities, contractors in all phases of home weatherization, workforce development programs at Piedmont Virginia Community College, with city and county staff ongoing. The challenge is to create a model that works here, that can be replicated in other parts of the country to achieve wonderful savings on utility bills by individual families and also help us with our climate control goals. Again, we are out in front on an issue trying to make a model that works. The stormwater regulations, I'm sure you've heard about those. They're trickling from Washington, D.C. down to Richmond and will be trickling in our way by the fall of this year. This spring and summer, our representatives from both jurisdictions on the Rivanna River Basin Commission are working on figuring out ways in which our local governments can be involved in the design of the implementation rules for controlling our pollution, reducing our runoff, and therefore improving our headwater streams, the streams and tributaries of the Rivanna. Our task is to make improvements locally, and those combined improvements will, from all the areas in the state, will help the Chesapeake Bay. But there's a lot of uncertainty about the programs. We do know from recent conversations yesterday at a conference in Stanton that whatever improvements we make today, we will have credit for when the regulations come forward. So that's an inspiration for us to not wait, but to make what small steps we can everywhere to improve our streams and rivers. Over all this hangs the lack of transportation funding that ties our region together. Some of you have, or may have, like me, enjoyed riding to Washington, D.C. on the new train, which began last October 1st. It has been a great success in ways we didn't anticipate, because even though the Lynchburg train doesn't leave Charlottesville early enough to get you to a 9 o'clock or a 10 o'clock meeting in Washington, the fact that the Lynchburg train is here and taking so many of us recreational riders has freed up the Crescent at 7 in the morning, so people can, even a week in advance, get a ticket to Washington, which was never a possibility in the last years. So this is a great advance. We credit our state funders for offering the subsidy to try this train, and I'm very happy to report that ridership is so high that it's actually returning subsidy dollars to the Department of Rail and Public Transportation in Richmond. So one of those successes we'd like to hang on to and make it go even further. Our combined community has a long list of priority transportation projects, as you all know, to many of them right around this area, Hillsdale Drive, Berkmar Extended, to get our local drivers off of 29 and therefore improve the regional transportation network in that way. And so we're trying to make our local steps, make our local contributions as we can, and there is much to do. So I'm going to stop there, and I look forward to many of your questions, and we'll learn from you as well. Thank you.
And there will be plenty of opportunity and time for questions later. Again, we are deeply honored to have the two-time mayor of the city of Charlottesville, Dave Norris. He was mayor elected in 2008 and again in 2010, and he has served the city well. I have a business downtown, and I can attest to the value of his listening and paying attention to the people who are downtown. So, Dave, give us the state of the city.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you all for inviting me here today. It's great to be with you. You know, you realize early on when you join city council that city council does not exist in a vacuum. The city of Charlottesville does not exist in a vacuum. There are relationships that affect what we do and what we're able to do. And I want to start by talking a little bit about the relationships and some of the constraints that we have as a city, as a city council. First of all, is affecting our relationship between the city and the Commonwealth of Virginia. Many of you may know that Virginia is what we call a Dillon Rule state, which essentially means that localities in Virginia are pretty constricted on what we can do. Anytime we want to do anything innovative, creative, we have to go to Richmond and beg for permission to do things, even if they only affect what happens in the 10 square miles that is the city of Charlottesville. This puts restricts our ability to be responsive to our citizens and to be creative and innovative in responding to challenges that affect our city. It can be very frustrating at times having to go down, and the county has to do it too, having to go down to Richmond and beg for permission on things that we should be able to do on our own. So that's a constraint right there. Secondly, is the relationship between the city and the county of Albemarle. You may know Virginia is the only state in the country that has the system of independent cities that we so enjoy here. If Charlottesville were in any other state in the country, 49 other states, Charlottesville would be a city within Albemarle County. We would be part of Albemarle County. We would be able to draw from the tax base of Albemarle County. We would share services with Albemarle County. You wouldn't have this artificial divide between city and county that we have here in Virginia, which I think is thoroughly dysfunctional. It creates all kinds of inefficiencies in government, and it creates sets up a spirit of antagonism between the city and the county. Now, we have taken quite a number of steps over the years to try to bridge that gap, but it's despite the system of local government here, not because of the system of local government here. So, and this issue flares up. Every few years it flares up. It's flaring up right now. And I wish we could get past it. I wish we could do away with the system of independent cities and adopt the same essential structure that every other state in the country has. But we like to be different here in Virginia. Third is the relationship between the city council and the city manager. Many people may not know that the city, we have a system of government in the city of Charlottesville. We call it a council manager form of government, where you have what we call a weak mayor, strong manager form of government. The city manager, who's a professional, who's hired by city council, runs City Hall on a day-to-day basis, just as the county executive runs the county office building on a day-to-day basis. The mayor of Charlottesville is a, I guess, technically a part-time job. that's what they say. As you probably know, the mayor is just chosen among the five councilors, and it's not directly elected. And essentially, it is the city manager. And that form of government was adopted in the early part of the 20th century to try to weed out corruption and politics in a city administration, so that you wouldn't have everything that City Hall does be tainted by politics. And it's supposed to, you have a professional class that's running the show instead of politicians that are running the show. So, you have all these constraints on what we can do, and yet, despite all these constraints, and sometimes because of some of these relationships and constraints, we're still able to get a lot done. When I ran for city council back in 2006, I had four issues that I had sort of on my short list of things that I wanted to try to tackle in my time on city council. And I think we've made good progress on all of these fronts. We haven't solved any of these problems. We're not close to solving any of these problems, but the first had to do with affordable housing. Depending on how you look at the numbers, we are either first or second in the state in the gap, the size of the gap between housing costs and wages here in Charlottesville-Albemarle. It's very expensive, particularly for the working class, the people who make this city function. It's very expensive for them to be able to live in Charlottesville. Now, the recent downturn in the housing market has helped to make homes more affordable, but it's still a major challenge that we face, that our citizens face, our neighbors face, and it causes, the lack of affordable housing causes people to make some pretty difficult decisions. We have a lot of people who are paying significantly more than they really should be expected to pay for housing. And so that means they're having to cut back on other essentials. We have a lot of people that are having to move 30, 40 miles away to find housing they can afford, which puts a lot of strain on our roads and on their family budget with gas costs. So we have a lot of people who are having to work multiple jobs to afford housing in the city, which is time away from their children. We have a lot of people who are settling for overcrowded or substandard housing, and we do have some residents who go homeless for lack of affordable housing. So it's a major challenge. We have significantly increased housing funds in the last few years. We've been able to preserve or expand in the hundreds the number of affordable housing units in the city in the last few years because of the increase in funding, but it's still a significant issue. Two is the environmental sustainability. This has been a major thrust of the city, the city council, and the county of Albemarle in recent years, to where now we were both honored last year by the Virginia Municipal League in their Go Green Government Challenge as some of the greenest localities in the Commonwealth. And we are practicing, down the line. When it comes to, just in the last few years, we've significantly increased our curbside recycling program. We've launched this new city-county energy efficiency initiative that Ann discussed. We have retrofitted about 30 of our own municipal buildings, including schools, to make them more energy efficient. We're already realizing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year in tax in savings from utility bills, reduced utility bills from those improvements. We've increased support for transit, for bicycling, walking, getting people out of their single occupancy vehicles, ridership on our bus system, which is the city operates the bus system, but it serves the county as well, has gone from 1.5 million 2 years ago to 2 million last year, or 3 years ago to 2 million last year. That's a significant increase in ridership on transit. There's a number of other things that we've been doing on the environmental front, so I feel like we're making good progress, but there's a lot left to do. Third is race and poverty. We have serious issues with race relations in our community. This is not unique to Charlottesville, but we certainly want to do more to try to bridge the gap between people of different backgrounds in our community. And one of the things we've done that we're doing right now, and some of you may be participating, in fact, I know at least one of you is participating, is we have a community dialogue on race where we're bringing together people from a wide variety of backgrounds, over 600 residents of this community, not just city residents, but county residents as well, who are coming together on a weekly basis to talk about race. It's a very difficult topic, but we need to talk about it and talk about how people from different backgrounds experience life here in Charlottesville. Poverty is a major challenge in our community. 25% of our citizens in the city of Charlottesville live below the poverty line. Now, that number is a little bit deceptive because it does include some UVA students who live off grounds, who live in the city limits, who are technically poor because they're not earning an income, but they're voluntarily poor. It's temporarily poor. So, but we do know that there's still a significant issue of poverty in our community. About 54% of our school children qualify for free reduced lunch. That's a common indicator of economic need. So there's a significant issue with poverty. It's generational in many cases, too many cases, and we've got to do a better job of addressing that. One of the things that we're doing really well, which is definitely impacting our ability to address poverty in a negative way, is that we're sending our manufacturing jobs overseas. Historically, manufacturing has been the best avenue out of poverty and into the middle class for people who aren't on a college track, aren't on a professional track. And in the last decade, in this region, we have lost. We're hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs by the thousands. That is to our own detriment, and we've got to step up our efforts. And I know the county's talking a lot about this now, and I'd like the city to get more aggressive about it as well, to attract those light industrial jobs, those skilled trades, because not everybody is on a college track, not everybody is on a professional track. And for those who aren't, having them end up in retail and service jobs for their entire lives isn't really helping them out in the long run. It's hard to advance, it's hard to really get in a stable position when you're flipping burgers for a living, you know. One of the challenges that we have, and this goes to the fourth issue that I brought up in my campaign, is the fact that in the city of Charlottesville alone, which only has 40,000 people, 5,000 adults in the city of Charlottesville alone do not have a high school diploma. That is a recipe for failure. I mean, not to say that you can't get ahead without a high school diploma, but it's certainly going to impact your ability to get ahead. And so we've got to do more, and we're trying now to do more, to capture kids at an early age to make sure they're not dropping out of school, they're staying in school, staying focused on what they need to do, staying focused on success in life. One of the things that we've done, so the fourth issue I brought up is youth opportunity in education. One of the things that we've done is to dramatically expand the size of our youth employment program, summer youth employment program, summer jobs for youth, which is helping many children in our community to learn the value of work. And to learn what it means to be successful in the workplace, how to dress appropriately, how to show up on time, how to speak appropriately, how to interact appropriately in the workforce. And if any of you are employers or in a position to hire people, I'm sure you see it all the time where people come in and they're clearly not ready for work. They're clearly not ready to succeed because they've never gotten that grounding. And this program is going to help more and more young people each year to get that grounding and to get onto a better track. We also are fully committed to funding our public school system. We are committed to providing high-quality after-school and summer enrichment opportunities for youth. So I feel like we're making good progress. The dropout rate is declining, and standardized test scores are increasing, but we still have a long way to go. Now, so that's sort of the four issues that I raised and that I've really devoted much of my time to. But one thing that I noticed, and I'm sure you've seen this too, is despite whatever your own intentions are when you run for office, if any of you, once you get into office, you deal with what I call the inbox effect, which is you may have all the ideas in the world about things you want to do, but you quickly find that a lot of other people have ideas for you as well. And so we get flooded all the time with issues that come up, things that need our immediate attention, controversies that come out of left field. And you can easily do nothing more in your time in office than respond to your inbox and lose sight of those issues that motivated you to run for office. I'll give you a perfect example of this. When I ran for office in 2006, we thought we had solved our community water supply challenge. Right? We thought we had that done. In fact, I don't even remember I think maybe once it came up in the campaign trail in 2006, because the assumption was that we had figured that out and we had a plan and we were going to implement that plan. Well, there's probably no issue in the last year and a half, that's commanded more of my own attention than coming up with a good water supply plan. And it's because some very legitimate questions were raised by some people in this room, Mr. Fife, and others, about the fundamental assumptions underlying the water supply plan. And it's caused us to reevaluate some of those assumptions, which I think is the responsible thing to do when legitimate concerns are raised and criticisms are raised. That issue has taken a huge amount of time in the last year. Just in the last 3 months, we have a restaurant in Belmont, Bel Rio, which you've read about, which has caused an uproar in that neighborhood about noise coming from music playing late at night and keeping neighbors awake. That's taken a lot of our time to try to address. You know, these things come up, and you never know what's going to come next. Barking dogs, right? So, in terms of where we're going, and some of the challenges that I still see in the near term and perhaps long term future, clearly this issue of city county cooperation is front and center now, and we have to figure out a better way to work together. I have always gotten along very well with the county supervisors of all political persuasions. It's not an individual thing at all. It's really partly fueled by this dysfunctional system of governance, which puts us at odds because of these arbitrary divide between city and county. But it's partly because of history, and it's partly because of when you're under financial duress, I think people make decisions that they may not be the best decisions, and I think that we've got to move beyond it and figure and realize that we can get a lot more done by working together than by being at each other's throats. And so I hope we can proceed in a better way in that regard. Secondly, is the fiscal situation. This is a tough time to be in government. The revenues are down on the local level, revenues are down on the state level, and localities everywhere are having to make very difficult choices. Now, thankfully, in the city, we're in pretty decent fiscal shape. We've made some good decisions over the years that have kept us in decent fiscal shape. We also have a populace that's willing to pay more in taxes than, say, Alamar County. it's because they value the services that the city provides, that they get from their taxes. We had a budget survey, we got the results just in the last couple weeks, where we asked our citizens, are you happy with the level of taxes and the level of services in our community? We gave them a bunch of choices. We said, would you like to see us increase services and increase taxes, or decrease services and decrease taxes, or increase services and decrease taxes? And over 60%, a strong majority, said, we like it pretty much the way it is now. We want you to keep the same level of taxes, keep the same level of services. So people are willing to pay a little bit higher, because they value having good schools, they value having good parks and recreation, they value having a good police department, good fire department, good libraries down the line. But it's still a difficult situation, and we have to continually stay on top of it. And perhaps the most important thing that we can do in the city of Charlottesville is to redouble our efforts to strengthen our own tax base so that we're, as revenues are and funding is on the decline from the state level and other sources of funding are on the decline, that we can ensure that we're getting the revenue we need. And that means making sure that Charlottesville is a good place for employers to run a business, to create jobs, to sustain a business. This has to be front and center, both for our tax base and just for our own citizens. Even though we still have a relatively low unemployment rate in this area, it is certainly higher than it was 2 years ago. And we need to put our residents back to work, and we need to make sure that we maintain a healthy tax base. These are just some of the challenges and some of the issues that we grapple with. In general, I've really enjoyed being in public office. Being the mayor of Charlottesville is a great honor. I get to work with wonderful people like Jim and Morgan and many others to help make good decisions for this community. But as Ann said, we can't do it alone. We really need you. We really need the citizens to stay involved, stay informed, and keep us on our toes. So thank you.
Thank you, Ann and Dave, for making us aware of the many issues. A lot of things I learned from this presentation, and I can't think of anything that is quite defined as working this hard, putting in these long hours, making decisions on these very important issues to so many people, and calling it a part-time job. That boggles me. So I'm going to open this to questions now. If you have a question, please raise your hand. Bill, we have a question right down here. And please use the mic to form your question, and we'll get the answers from these people. You may direct it to either Ann or Dave. And isn't it wonderful that we can call them Ann and Dave and that they listen to us and they're just like neighbors? It's really great. Or to both.
Yes. I've been hearing about the Dillon Rule for years, and I'm wondering if either one of you would tell me when this came into being, and whose interest is it that it keeps it there? Mostly I hear, you know, the Dillon Rule and then a lot of cussing afterwards. So why is this still here?
I'll start.
It was something in the middle of the 19th century. There was a judge in Kansas or somewhere named Dillon who came up with this approach to government where it should be centrally, the power should be centralized. And the opposite of it is the home rule, which is what New England town meeting would be an example of home rule, where you go to town meeting and you decide everything, right down to the penny, and the state is much lower on the totem pole. So in, as Dave said, in Virginia, the county especially, even more so than the city, is very much in a mother may I position with the state legislature. We are only allowed to, by statute, deal with things that protect the health and safety of our citizens. Now that it's called the police powers. Now that includes zoning, because that's deciding how our life is going to be. And so one of the reasons why zoning decisions are so hotly contested is because it's one of the few places where we do actually have jurisdiction, and setting the tax rate to tax ourselves to accomplish whatever we can. That's the short answer. Do you want to add something to that?
Yeah, I can answer that.
The House of Delegates, I would guess, but anyway.
Well, you know, people often say, how can we get rid of the Dillon Rule? And essentially you're asking the General Assembly to give up power. And I don't know that they're ever going to willingly do that. However, there is one argument for sustaining at least the Dillon Rule in some form, which is that when it comes to business regulation, you don't want every single locality in the Commonwealth to have its own set of regulations that businesses need to abide by and have this complete patchwork quilt, which makes Virginia a difficult state to do business in. But I think there's a way to maintain consistency in regulation of business while still allowing innovation and creativity in local governance. I'll give you a perfect example of why the Dillon Rule is absurd. This year, our clerk of council, Jeannie Cox, is retiring. She's been in office many years, and she's wonderful, and we're sorry to see her go. We set out to hire a replacement. We advertised for a replacement. And when we started this, we realized that there is a provision in our original charter for the city that lists a number of positions in City Hall that have to be city residents. They have to live within the 10 square miles of the city of Charlottesville. And for whatever reason, at the time when the city charter was established, the clerk of council was one of those positions. We have candidates applying for this job who live in Albemarle County and are excellent candidates. And essentially, this provision, this in the city charter, would require us. We would not be allowed to interview any of these candidates or discuss the job with any of these candidates unless they agreed to move into the city if they got the job. And that's asking a lot of somebody to uproot their family, and housing's expensive, et cetera, et cetera. So we just said, well, let's just change that, right? And then our city attorney, which he often does, said, Dylan rule. And so we had to get a bill introduced in the General Assembly this year, in the Senate and in the House, and it goes through all the legislative channels, and it spends a lot of their time and energy, that would simply allow the city of Charlottesville to hire a clerk of council who doesn't live in the city of Charlottesville. It's ridiculous. This is one position in one locality that we'd like to, you know, one little line in our city charter that we'd like to change. It's not going to affect any other locality in the entire Commonwealth, but because of the Dylan rule, we have to go and do this song and dance in Richmond, which is just ridiculous. So,
and the Dylan rule also benefits organizations, home builders, or the insurance industry, or whatever, because a home builder lobbyist actually said to me personally several years ago, why would we want to deal with 100 jurisdictions when we can go down to the House of Delegates and with one stroke of the pen get our interests taken care of all at once? So it is a different power structure. And the other awful example of the power of the General Assembly over our lives in general is the communications tax, which you may or may not know about. I didn't know about it until a week or so ago, which is bad for me, being an elected official. But many years ago, there were each locality had local taxes for any kind of communications, telephone, internet, cable, things like that. This is local revenue, locally controlled revenue, locally taxed revenue. And at someone's instigation, it may have been the communications industry, the state decided that they would create a trust fund and put all the collected taxes from Charlottesville and Albemarle and other places into this trust fund and then dole it back out. And this allows a more efficient collection, et cetera. However, what happens is that we have now lost control of this money. And one of the grievous things that the House of Delegates wants to do to us now is to break the trust fund and take $40 million of localities' money for themselves, and then consider handing out the rest of it according to the proportion of what we put in. So the budget game this year is one series of bait and switch after another, and it's infuriating from my perspective. The sheriff's money is being taken from the schools, and the school's money is being taken from the telephones, and basically they're playing a shell game with us, and it's very upsetting.
Thank you very much. I'm from Kansas, and I guess I should I apologize for the state of Kansas in the Dylan rule. Bill, back there.
I've got a question for you, David. You've said many times about how dysfunctional the city-county breakdown is. Now, what, about 10 years ago, we tried to revert to town status. I gather we can do that whether the Board of Supervisors wants us in their merry band or not. Are you in favor of reverting to town status? And if you are, would you be willing to lead such a charge?
I would much I am not a particularly big champion of reversion for a number of reasons. However, if that's the only option left on the table that would get us get us to a better and healthier way of governance, I would consider it. But my preference, given the system we have now, would be, as I said earlier, to figure out which services that we can consolidate with Albemarle County And, you know, if you go down the line, you think about, you know, why do we have two different parks and recreation departments? Why do we have two different departments of social services? Why do we have two different Section 8 housing programs? Why do we have, you know, just down the line, and we have to ask ourselves, you know, where does it make sense to consolidate? And some of these, it may not, at the end of the day, make sense. But I think we have to, you know, and I should note, we've done a lot already. I mean, we have a joint library system. We have a joint technical education center. We have a joint jail. We have a joint airport. We have a joint water and sewer system, solid waste down the line at the moment. So there are quite a number of things where we have worked things out. But again, if push comes to shove, and reversion is the only option left on the table, I would not rule it out. But when reversion was considered, it was also done at a time when the city was in much more dire financial condition than it is now. And at the time, I think many people in the city felt like it was the only hope the city had in the long run. But I think between consolidating services, working closer together, and then continuing and redoubling our efforts to strengthen our tax base, that would be my preference.
Mm-hmm. It sounds as if you'd like the dysfunctional system.
I don't. My ultimate preference is to get rid of, as I said in my remarks, is to get rid of that system of independent cities. I don't know that that will ever happen in our lifetime, but that is my strong preference, is to say, let's do what every 49 other states do and figure out how we can continue to operate as a city, but be part of Albemarle County. And again, that's essentially what reversion does in a modified extent. But I can guarantee you, if and when reversion ever comes back on the table, it will generate a firestorm of a pushback from Albemarle County. Because when you revert to a town, all of your obligations now become the county's obligations, which means their tax rate is going to increase dramatically in order to fund those municipal services that the city residents want. And so it could get ugly.
Well, I think it was the player in people's minds when 60-some percent of the population voted for the revenue sharing agreement back in 82, because there was no way for the city to survive unless, number one, they annexed, number two, they reverted, or number three, we worked out some contractual arrangement. And that's what I try to convey to citizens of mine who jump up and down on a regular basis about this, and why don't we just stop paying and all that. Well, it's a legally adopted contract. It was supported by referendum, and at the time seemed like a really good idea. It would be wonderful to be able to get together and have a meaningful discussion about how it's working out every few years or something like that. And I'm very hopeful that that will be one of the things that we will talk about when we continue our two city councilors, two supervisors meetings, as we have been doing for a number of years. I do want to point out, however, that when you go someplace else in Virginia or to the any kind of government training meeting, people always look at my name tag and say, oh, you're from Albemarle. You and Charlottesville work so well together. We have such a terrible relationship with our neighboring town, and we're always at each other's throats. So even though we may see that we need to improve things, the view of us from others is much more rosy. And that's probably pretty typical of circumstances where those of us in the trenches would always want to do something better. But each of our communities has tremendous character of their own. And I can understand, I've raised this idea with parents when I was in Richmond teaching at Venable, and I would say, well, what do you think about school unification? And they'd say, well, no, you know, the county doesn't do what we want to have done for our, they don't have the fine arts programs, they don't have the emphasis on things that the city schools have. But just as Dave was saying, if we can find ways to link our schools in the most beneficial way. What if we have 25 children who want to take Arabic and they're at four different high schools? I mean, it would be great to be able to technologically link those school children together. And it's one of the benefits of the dramatic proposal that our school board made and upset all their parents tremendously of going to a 4x4 schedule, to have the all the high schools be on the same schedule so that they could share a teacher and be able to work with a video link or something like that. Little Nelson County to our south is not as populated or as wealthy, but they have a virtual learning system in Nelson County that students use from all over the world. They got money for this from the rural electrification grants that, small counties have access to. They are way ahead of us. So we have many opportunities to continue our tremendous educational benefits, to have county children be able to participate in orchestra somehow by having the time be at a time when they can run down there. I mean, when my own child was in high school, she took classes at UVA and took classes at PVCC at the same time that she was doing things at high school, and it was a nightmare organizing it. So I understand when you multiply that by 15,000 children that scheduling is a real problem. But it's one of the things we can hold out as an opportunity.
Well, the emphasis nationally is jobs, jobs, jobs. You mentioned this as of vital importance, and I'd be interested in your comments of what we're able to do in that respect, the organization of the people that are working on this, and whether they need any additional help or a reorganization in view of the fact that nationally everyone has the same problem, so the competition is extremely great.
That's a great point. There are a number of things that we are doing now. When we talk to employers, what you often hear is they want a workforce that's ready to work and that's relatively well educated. They want to know that they have the infrastructure in place to support their business, water, sewer, roads, etc. They want to know that, you know, your city bureaucracy is not going to be difficult to navigate. So there are things that we are working on now. We are part of a regional organization with the county and others called the Thomas Jefferson Partnership for Economic Development, TJPED, which tries to better position our region to attract and grow business. I would like to see how we can step up our efforts through TJPED, through our own Office of Economic Development in the city, to even better position ourselves, because, you know, one salient example that affects me, and I imagine affects a lot of people, is just walking down the downtown mall these days, and there's so many vacant storefronts down there. That's very disturbing. That sends a signal that we are slipping. Our economic vitality is slipping. I've called a meeting for a week and a half from now to pull together some of the downtown business owners and figure out what more can we do. We're a little bit limited, partly because of the Dillon Rule and other things, on what we can do. For instance, one of the candidates for city council last year said we should waive commercial real estate taxes for all new startup businesses for a period of time as an incentive for new business creation. We can't do that. We don't have the legal authority to do something like that, even if we wanted to. But within the constraints that we have, I've got to believe there's more that we can do. And that issue is going to be front and center for me this year, because And I don't know if you want to add anything in.
Well, I agree. And Susan Steinbarn in the county and Chris Engel in the city do work very well together. I think we're not fighting with each other. We're actually working on a regional basis to try to bring businesses here. One of the problems in Albemarle is that we don't have a big stock of ready buildings. Purpose-built buildings are sometimes empty. Badger out there on 29 North, it was built for one reason and has had a difficult time finding someone else to move in. So some communities in more plush times financially were able to get a jump start, put in an industrial park or something, and they've been able to attract certain kinds of businesses to those places. To protect quality of life and to get a good product in Albemarle, we have perhaps overcompensated, but I think done a pretty good job with our zoning process. Is cumbersome, but has decent regulation to get a good product out. We have to find a balance between making sure that we ask the right questions of people and not questions just because we can, to try to speed up our processes to make them responsible and yet still have very high quality efforts being made. But we are definitely looking for jobs. We graduate 6,000 new employees every year. they frequently come back when they retire to move here. We don't need to be in one of those magazines that says we're such a great place to live, because the people I met going door to door said, oh yeah, we graduated from Darden and we all made a pact that we would come back in 30 years and live here. So I think there are many others in that same circumstance who have come back to our area. But we do have a real lack of jobs, entry-level jobs for young people. At the Workforce Network, which was a new experience for me as the board liaison 2 years ago, that is a group from city, county, business representatives, and also the representatives throughout Region 10 and Region 9, the Culpeper District, work together. This is for federal workforce training funds, something that's been very, very important to our displaced workers to help them get new skills. And you might have heard of the one-stop center that is on Hydraulic Road, which is the first one in the state, and actually brings all the different state agencies together under one roof to provide job services, job training services, rehabilitative services to people to help to get them back into the workforce for their own success and for their community's success. But we still have a long way to go on that as well.
Bill, over there.
Just add one more.
Oh, we'll get back to you. We have plenty of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Since the term revenue sharing has already been raised, I will ask this question that I've been wondering about for months now. Why is it that it's only now, almost 30 years later, that we're discovering this disparity in state funding, and that's this anomaly that's grown out of it? This must have been the case for the last however many years, almost 30 years.
It has been, and I think when times were not so desperate, people said, well, we don't think we're going to get anywhere, so we're not going to try. And basically, it had been discussed at the Albemarle County School Board level off and on for the last 15 years. And that was part, I think, of the original revenue sharing discussion, and it was decided at the time to leave it out. And apparently at the same time, although I haven't read all the notes to make sure, people have told me that the discussion, formula for land use value was also discussed at that time, and it was decided by the collaborative effort to use market value for all the property. So those are two things that we might have looking back, we could say we would have done differently if we could have. But whether we could have achieved an agreement, you know, at that point or not, it's pure conjecture at this point.
And essentially, what this proposed amendment would do is to, what it purports to do is have the state's school funding formula reflect the revenue sharing agreement between the city and the county, and but the problem is, from the city's perspective, is that the proposed amendment only reflects one side of the revenue sharing equation. What it does is it says Albemarle County should get credit for the roughly $18 million that they transfer to the city every year, and that that should be factored in to the level of funding that Albemarle County gets and that we get from the state. What it doesn't do is factor in the $25 million or more that the city loses every year from the revenue sharing agreement through our decision not to annex property that we had every right and opportunity to annex. It's only giving the county credit for their loss. It's not giving the city credit for our loss. And above and beyond that, you have the whole sort of reverse Robin Hood effect, where they're taking money from a school system that serves a much higher or much lower needs, higher needs, lower income student population, and giving it to a school system which has a much lower, higher need, whatever. lower
formula going forward too. The General Assembly is being much more punishing to Charlottesville going forward than it is to the county. And that's just the way the hand we're being dealt right now, which compounds the problem.
And one quick thing, if this amendment passes, it's going to force the city to do one of three things. One is we either have to cut the school budget by up $2.8 million next year, which is the equivalent of about 40 teachers. Or we'll have to increase our own property tax rate, which is already 20 cents higher than the county's. Or we're going to have to figure out some other way to recoup that money from Albemarle County. And then that'll get us into this real nasty tit-for-tat with Albemarle County. There's no good choice that we're left with if this amendment passes.
OK, Okay, do we have, okay, back here, please. And we'll get to you. Okay, I got you.
One thing that sort of surprises me is that no one has mentioned this big 500-pound gorilla that's right over the backs of both of you. We call the University of Virginia. And I don't see a third representative up there, but they are pretty important to almost all decisions that are made. And not only that, a lot of the revenues that the county, at least, and in many cases the city too, have lost have been because of the acquisitions of the University of Virginia. What?
Well, it is a complaint I have made to our staff as this has come to light. Because in other places where I have lived, other universities have been very generous and provided six-figure in lieu of payments to small towns for fire service and that sort of thing. And I think the city does get some benefit for fire service from the university properties. But it is a dilemma. On the bright side, and I'm always trying to find a half glass full when I can, the stability that the presence of the university provides to our employment and to our quality of life is unmeasurable. And so I do try to speak forcefully but politely, because we do have great benefits from their presence here. It's what makes our region different from so many other rural counties in Virginia. But we're always looking. I'm cultivating an acquaintance and friendship with the new president, and hopefully we will have more good conversations. She's a very friendly lady, and I look forward to her arrival. Mr. Sandbridge is also retiring, which is going to be a very big game changer. And who gets put into that spot is going to make a huge difference to the county and the city as we go forward. One of the things I'm enjoying being a new appointee to is the PAC, the Partnership for Community Cooperation, that the city, county, and university representatives meet quarterly to talk about things. So we do have the structure in place to continue doing well, but I get your point, whether it's nonprofit hospitals or all the buildings that the university owns, the Research Foundation owns, which are leased to commercial properties, I think North Grumman out at the town center, the University Research Park, those are actually taxed at market rate. So we do, even though they probably could take us to court and figure out a way to weasel out of that, thankfully they have not. And the questionable ones are whether the it's academic buildings, how it's interpreted, and that's something that's unique to Virginia. Thanks.
Could you please address the solid waste issue? I know the city and the county have very different systems. I know the Rivanna Solid Waste Authority is seriously underfunded and I think in danger of disappearing, but that's my personal opinion. And I'm wondering what you think is the future of solid waste management in this community.
Okay. I don't have the answer to that, Lois, because it is something that's in flux right now, and I think it's proper. Well, anyway, in the next month or so, there will be discussions of proposals that are being made for the management of the Ivy Landfill, and whether a private industry would like to take that on to manage it. So that's one consideration. There has been a commitment made to the Ivy residents that will not be expanded as a live landfill, shall we say. But from the trash haulers in the western part of the county, my district, they're very upset about the fact that there would not be a transfer station anymore anywhere close to them, and they're looking at a 60-mile round trip to go to a place in Fulvana. I am frankly thrilled that I can take my little Mini Cooper full of all the plastics and cans and papers and cardboard and everything else to Whole Foods when I go grocery shopping and heave it all into the big orange container, because that saves me lots of time and space at my house and is a tremendous benefit. Maybe that's the kind of an example of the way we might be able to go forward, and whether regional business groups will consider inviting a private contractor commingling positioned to be in the back of their parking lot or something like that as a way to go forward. All of us who participated in the solid waste study, which was 3 years ago, I keep asking where the report is and nobody ever shows it to me. I think everybody in the crowd the night that I was there wanted to go straight to the MRF, you know, the energy generation, total using of our trash, and deal with it here and get the benefits from it. But the $5 million price tag is getting in the way right now. So that may interfere with our ability to do what we really would like to do.
I think this is also one of those instances where the private sector and where technology are both ahead of where we are in the public sector. And we have to figure out to what extent do we want to take advantage of the technology and of the advances that have been made in the private sector to improve solid waste management. The City Council is having a work session on April 21st to address this very subject of what is the future of solid waste, what is the city's role in Rivanna Solid Waste Authority. So stay tuned. It's a big issue.
I live in the northern part of Albemarle County, and I use Rio Road a lot. My question is, with the completion of the Meadow Creek Parkway, will it ultimately result in having to add more lanes on Rio Road? Because it is very serious at certain times of the day. Going from, say, 29 all the way to 250 bypass. It's very, very critical sometimes.
Mr. Faltz, are you there listening? I don't think the widening from KTEC to 250 bypass is in the long-range plan.
No,
and
that's one of the reasons
the Meadow Creek Parkway was supposed to take that traffic off of Park Street, Rio Road. So that's a 2013, I guess, is that delivery time. Yeah.
Okay, we have a question right here, Bill. And then we'll get back to you.
Can you explain the power relationship between the county and the city as far as annexation is concerned? In other words, if the city wants to expand to those areas that they seem to serve all the time, how does that happen?
It would have to be voluntary. There's a temporary moratorium. The state has put a temporary moratorium on involuntary annexation by cities of county real estate. So it would have to be a voluntary agreement. And, you know, we've sort of half-jokingly said, yeah, we'll be happy to give up the revenue sharing agreement if you let us annex those properties. because at the end of the day, we would be ahead financially. If we had annexed that property back in 1980, 1981, that we had every right and opportunity to annex, we would be realizing more revenue than we do through the revenue sharing agreement. However, it would have had some negative impacts in terms of growth in the county. You would have seen much more push by the county to grow beyond where they now have their growth areas because so much of that real estate would be in the city limits. So I think the revenue sharing agreement has served our community well in a number of ways. That's one of them. But that's right now it would have to be done on a voluntary basis where the county agreed to allow the city to annex property.
If the moratorium is lifted, and the soonest that would be, according to the last General Assembly attention, was 2019, then there still would have to be a slightly different service provision than what we have now. Back in the early 80s, the city was very organized and had all the services, and the county was a couple of little neighborhoods and basically a very rural environment. We didn't have a lot of urban services, which now the county does provide around the donut, around the urban ring is what we call it. So there does have to be an imbalance of services in order for annexation to go forward. Which probably would interfere with it happening and being awarded. It has to go through a court process anyway, and someone else gets to decide. But that circumstance has changed a little bit now.
Keep in mind, though, that we made a commitment in the revenue sharing agreement not to annex. That was one of the bargains that we made. So even if the moratorium is lifted, we would not be, we are held to that agreement, which is why we're hoping the county holds to its side of the agreement with the annual
bill
payments.
Right down here, and then we'll get you. We have a question back there, too.
This is an addendum, in a way, to the comment of the woman who spoke about Meadow Creek. It sometimes appears, as a resident, that there's not a good integration of local transportation with county development. I'm particularly thinking of the Free Bridge bottleneck, which is getting only worse by the hour, and the planned development of Pantops. I suspect there's a similar issue with Crozet development. And I know that the Meadow Creek, I'm a hiker and I get out to see what's happening with the Meadow Creek development. And I just sometimes wonder, is anyone talking? Are you talking to each other about the impacts of transportation in Charlottesville with county development?
That's for sure. And the connection of land use and transportation on a planning level is something within the last decade that's really become part of everyday conversation. Because in the past, our zoning basically was based in the 80s on what the landowners wanted. When they established zoning, they basically surveyed the landowners and said, okay, what do you want to be? And they'd say, well, I want to have a factory, so I'm going to be heavy industrial. Whether it was out in Earlysville or Crozet, there wasn't a planning basis for it. That was just the way it evolved. People of the time will remember and consider it fairly much a miracle that zoning got passed, period. I mean, it took about 15 years to get it passed, even in that very rudimentary level. So we have evolved to some extent. And I think we've evolved quite well procedurally as far as understanding now what the traffic implications are going to be for changes in land use. But there's so much that's been built that was really approved 10, 15 years ago. And we're way behind as far as having our current understanding be applied to old permits, for example. We currently in the county have 13,000 units that have been approved in planning and rezonings that haven't yet been built. And so over the next 15 or 20 years, some of those will be built, and probably our regulations and understanding will evolve between now and then, but they will still be able to be built under what the approvals were that they received in 2003, for example, or 2005. So it is a balance for sure.
And I think too often what happens is that we allow the growth to happen before we plan the infrastructure to be able to absorb and sustain that growth and to manage that growth. And that's backwards. It needs to be, we need to have the infrastructure in place first, and if we don't have the infrastructure, then we shouldn't allow the growth.
It seemed like the historic proposal was to let the developers provide the infrastructure rather than the taxpayers. Other counties have done it differently. Hanover, for example, back in the 70s, set out concentric rings. And they said for the first 10 years, we're going to have services available inside this ring. It's right around Route 95 in Ashland. That was the center core. And so businesses, because the county provided the services in that ring, that's where the businesses went. It was very organized and very well laid out. But the county made the first investment to make it happen. And then as that one began complete, then they moved out to the next ring. It's just a completely different point of view historically here.
Earlier you had commented that one of the problems of attracting industry was the fact that what is available is not readily appropriate and need to be modified. I would just like to call attention to a conversation I have to have had with an architect yesterday who said to me that one of the real problems is the red tape in getting modifications. He really lamented the fact that he had had several clients where they had given up just because of the red tape. And they were absolutely astounded at what was involved to get the approval. So if you can, as a council, can address that issue, I'm sure that would be helpful.
We're working on this county as well.
Okay, question back here.
I know that both of you are still discussing your budgets, but I have a question. I want to know why you are even thinking of giving millions of dollars to help build the YMCA and still cutting education and helping to fund firing 27 teachers, especially in Albemarle.
I'd like to know the rationale for this.
All right. This has been, 15 years, I think? Something is before my time, unfortunately, but I will be glad to address it. The investment is a $2 million investment from the county for a capital project in which we will not have any operational cost. So from a strictly dollars and cents point of view, if the county were to be considering building a swimming facility of this type, we're basically saving $8 million by having the YMCA build it instead. Now that's completely separate from any sort of territorial decision, but from a strictly dollars and cents point of view, from the county's structural assets. That seemed to be a very good investment from their perspective. It would not be used, it would be highly unlikely, and I have not heard anybody on the current board who would support taking capital investment money as we have for this project and putting it into operating. We try to keep the operating budget functioning on a pay-as-you-go tax general fund method.
I can speak about this because I've been one of the strongest and proudest supporters of the YMCA project, because not only because it's going to save city and county governments millions and millions of dollars by working through a nonprofit rather than us operating our own recreational aquatic facility, but because of the quality of service that it's going to provide for young people and for families in our community. And in our case, the fact that the new YMCA will be located next door to our high school is going to provide a wonderful opportunity for kids in our high school to walk across the footbridge at the end of the school day and take advantage of the enrichment, recreational employment, and other opportunities that are available at the Y. Many communities around the country have Ys that are embraced by those communities because they know the value of having that kind of a program in place. For whatever reason, Charlottesville has never fully embraced the YMCA, but I'm fully confident that once it opens, people are going to realize that it's been a good investment of dollars and it's providing very rewarding opportunities and programs and services for young people and for families in our region.
And it's downtown as opposed to being a place where you'd have to take a car. So that's an excellent location.
Oh, and one more thing. It's not an either-or proposition. We don't have to starve the schools so that we can fund after-school programs. We can do both. We can make a choice to do both. Nobody in the city or county government is suggesting that it's an either-or proposition. We either fund the YMCA or we fund the schools. They're only the group that is making that argument is essentially a group of people who their primary motivation is they don't want to share McIntyre Park. Okay? And so and there's some legitimate reasons why they don't want to see this building built in McIntyre Park, but they've tried everything in the book to try to kill this project. First they said the YMCA is going to displace softball from McIntyre Park. Well, that didn't fly. Then they said the YMCA is going to displace the fireworks from McIntyre Park. Well, there's no truth to that either. Then they said the YMCA is going to displace the Dogwood Festival from McIntyre Park. That wasn't true either. I think they haven't gotten to the point of blaming the YMCA for the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, but I suspect that's next. But this is just the latest. The latest salvo is, well, the YMCA is responsible for defunding the schools. It's just not true. And so, anytime you see an ad, just question, ask yourself, what are the motivations behind this?
One follow-up to that, as far as the budget choice, I have been voted against the January 6th motion to roll back the tax rate to 74 cents because. And in conversations every day with my citizens, when they call and say, please don't raise my taxes, I ask them, can you live with paying the same amount you paid last year? And almost all of them have said yes. So that 2.5 cent or 2 cent to 76.4 would give us money to be able to cushion the damage to the schools and to fund our libraries properly and do a whole lot of things. So I am on a one-person campaign, and I'm not alone in this, to try to keep us at least at the equalized rate.
Okay, we have a question around here.
I'm concerned about the water problem, and it's also a question why every decision takes years and years and years because, for example, the bypass idea. I mean, we were going to meetings in 1990 about it, and I don't think the Meadow Creek Parkway is solving the basic problem. But now, the water. What if we have another drought the way we had about, 4 or 5 years ago? It's going to take a long time, and you see they make a decision, then there's another study about dredging. Then they make another decision, and there's a study about the dam. So why does it take so long, and what is the final answer?
It's a legitimate concern. I hear it a lot that it takes forever to make a decision. Then when we make a decision, then we change it. But we remake it. Right? But I think this is one case, the water supply plan specifically is one example where some assumptions were made in the planning process that have come to be questioned, and rightfully questioned. And I, for one, have supported doing more studies to see if there is a solution that is going to save us tens of millions of dollars and have much lower environmental impact than the plan that's on the table. But I have also been clear to say, I don't want to string this out for years longer. In fact, we should be at a point this year, this calendar year, 2010, by summer or fall, where we can make a final decision because we have all the data we need, or at least we're never going to get every single piece of data, but we'll have enough data to be able to make a decision. It's going to be a little bit dicey because, you know, the city and the county are in a different place right now in terms of, at least that's my sense. The majority of the county board seems to be pretty confident with the plan as it is. Majority of the city council seems to be saying maybe there's a better alternative. And so it might get a little interesting this fall, but hopefully we can come to a decision and not prolong this for 30 more years.
And there, this May, I'm looking forward to May because many of the studies are going to be complete. There are three or four different things that, where answers are going to be coming in May. So I'm very hopeful that we will have at that point enough information to go forward. One thing that isn't often spoken about, and I want to make sure to Mayor Norris that also, that the Sugar Hollow Pipeline is an elemental part of the current process that we have. It's 13 miles long. It's very old. It was built in 1905 or something like that. It's very leaky. So its replacement figure would have to be included if we were going to have a different plan than the one that is currently approved with the 6-mile pipeline. We don't really have a good amount of money, I guess, established for the 6-mile pipeline, but we have double that amount that we don't know for the Sugar Hollow Pipeline. Part of the water supply plan was to decommission the Sugar Hollow Pipeline, and because of its advanced state of disrepair, and to rely on the pumping from the Rivanna to the bathtub at Ragged Mountain instead. So I just want to make sure people keep that in mind, that that's one of those figures we need to put into the equation when we're comparing all the costs.
Thank you. We have time for one more question right down here, this gentleman.
Yes. My question is concerning the transportation again. You have changed your symbols on the buses, et cetera. How is that going to benefit the county? Are you going to expand? Because I know a number of people would like to have jobs like out at the hotel on 250 East and areas, and they can't get there. They don't have transportation, so...
You're referring, there's a proposal right now to rebrand our transit service. Right now it's Charlottesville Transit Service. We agreed to rename it Charlottesville Area Transit to try to reflect the fact that it's not just a city service, but that it is a regional partnership. There is a proposal that we're exploring to make that a formal structure, governance structure, to have, instead of have it be a city-operated transit service that the county contracts with, but to have it a jointly operated service. So this is all moving in that direction to get at your concern of the fact that there are significant employment centers in the county and residential centers in the county that are not currently served well or currently served at all by transit. We would like to continue to grow the transit system and even potentially beyond Albemarle County at some point, but it needs to be a robust system. One good thing about transit funding is that much of it does come from the federal government. So for this, for instance, a perfect example is this rebranding idea. If we were going to move forward, or when we move forward in actually doing rebranding and coming up with a new logo, that's going to cost about $90,000 total. But only $15,000 actually we have to pay for. Most of it comes from the federal government. Now, I will say one thing, and I'm breaking some news here. This hasn't, Roshana, you're hearing it for the first time. The city has actually put on hold the actual logo. It's still going to be Charlottesville Area Transit, CAT, but we got a good amount of feedback that people didn't like the actual logo itself. We're going to revisit the logo itself and come up with something that hopefully is more popular. So I'm breaking some news here at the Senior Center.
I just want to point out that this is a wonderful forum and opportunity. Where else can you have such a civil dialogue with people who have this much knowledge and depth of appreciation for our issues that are going on? And it's brought to you by the Senior Statesman of Virginia. So spread it around, tell your friends, have people come. They don't need to be a member, but we'd like their membership, and tell them. And I, again, would love to thank these people who've taken the time out of their busy, busy schedule to come here and address us with these issues. Thank you very much.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.